I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, as our international briefing continues, we'll head to Mexico to find out whether the arrest of the last known leader of a gang responsible for multiple kidnappings across the country will do anything to stem the kidnapping epidemic. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we continue our conversation about Secretary Hillary Clinton's trip to Africa. She began in Kenya, where she spoke at the annual trade forum tied to the U.S.-Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which was passed 9 years ago to encourage more trade with African countries.
You know that too often the story of Africa is told in stereotypes and cliches about poverty, disease, and conflict. We can't seem to get past the idea that the continent has enormous potential for progress. Too often the media's portrayal is so much less than that. But such notions are not only stale and outdated, they are wrong. Africa is capable and is making economic progress.
We wanted to take a closer look at that progress, the role of foreign investors like the U.S. and China, and how the global recession is affecting African economies. Joining me now to talk about all this is Todd Moss, Senior Fellow and Director of the Emerging Africa Project at the D.C.-based Center for Global Development. He's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the State Department. He's here with me in Washington. Also with us is Yusuf Reja. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Zebra Jobs. Now, that's a web portal that brings together employers in Africa and job seekers from the diaspora worldwide. Also joining us, Bob Johnson, the co-founder of Black Entertainment Television. More recently, he's been exploring business ventures in Africa as part of his work as chairman for RLJ Development. He's on the phone. Gentlemen, welcome, all of you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.
And Todd Moss, I'm going to start with you. In her speech at the trade forum in Kenya, Secretary Clinton was enthusiastic about the potential of the economy, but she also said, as many people have, that the African Growth and Opportunity Act, now 9 years old, has really not achieved as much as expected. How much of a difference has it made, and why hasn't it achieved as much as has been hoped?
Well, the reasons that Africa is not a major player in global trade are complex. One of the reasons is that big countries, big economies have had trade barriers in the past, and what AGOA did is just take down the American trade barriers. But that then means that African economies still need to be competitive. They need to export. They need to be able to compete with Thailand and China. And that's really where some of the barriers have been. But I think actually AGOA has been quite successful. A lot of the money, a lot of the trade's been in oil, but we've seen very strong growth in the non-traditional sectors. It's just that oil has grown so fast that it swamps the other numbers.
Secretary Clinton pointed to Rwanda, which has seen exceptional growth in recent years. Why is that?
Well, Rwanda's been one of the countries that's been most serious about tackling the domestic barriers to its own economic growth. A lot of African countries have terrible business regulations. It's virtually impossible in some countries to even open a small business, much less grow it, turn it into a globally competitive firm. But Rwanda's been really at the forefront in trying to remove those barriers and allow its own entrepreneurs to take off.
Bob Johnson, when we last talked, we spoke of your efforts mainly in Liberia. What's been your experience there?
Well, my experience in Liberia is one of where, under President Sirleaf, it's been absolutely open to bringing in business and to creating a climate where business can invest in Liberia. She's focused on issues regarding rule of law, contracts. She's focused on providing the capacity training, so you'll have business men and women in government who are structuring deals with outside investors. She pulled together a dynamic group of outside advisors ranging from George Soros to others to help her attract businesses.
Do you think, though, the main impediments to increased investment in Africa are the ones of just basic infrastructure, or are they ones of governance, the concerns about corruption, the concern about transparency?
My experience in dealing with Africa, and I've been going to Africa for a number of years, and the one thing that I found consistent is where there is political stability, business investment follows. And I use Ghana as the model. Ghana has transformed its economy dramatically, but that came about after political stability came, where you had change in power that was orderly, that was done according to a process. And business people feel very confident when you go in and sign a contract and know that contract is going to be honored. Those are the things that I think that follow. Where you find it not happening, sure, infrastructure is a big problem. But infrastructure requires investment. Investment follows, in my opinion, political stability and certainty of the ability to do business in a fair and open way.
Yusuf, you encourage African professionals to find jobs on the continent instead of looking for work in the West. And in essence, you're trying to reverse the brain drain. I'm just interested in what your experience has been so far since the portal has been up.
The main challenge for many of the professionals to go back to Africa is the lack of jobs that could match their own qualification and education that they have gained in the West. Once that is possible, many have shown an interest to go back to Africa. In addition, also, the bad image about Africa that we continuously hear about the corruption, the bad governance, has also become a discouraging factor for many to return. I always use an example of India. India has about 250 million people that live under $1 a day, but we don't talk about that much of on their poverty or that never been a deterrence to go and invest in India, because there are a lot of positive things also happening.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about economic progress in Africa on the occasion of Secretary Clinton's trip to the region. I'm joined by entrepreneurs Bob Johnson, the founder of BET. He's currently the chairman of RLJ Development and has business interests in Africa. Yusuf Reja, who runs an online web portal to match job seekers and employers in Africa. And Todd Ma, senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. There is a global recession. And Todd Ma, I wanted to ask, what effect do you think it's having in Africa? Some have said that the effects have not been as significant as in other parts of the world, but others say that any loss of growth has to be a problem.
Well, Africa didn't feel the initial impact. It wasn't very well integrated into the global financial markets. So the fall of Lehman Brothers that we saw last fall and the real shock that the global financial system took, Africa was insulated more or less from that, South Africa being a large exception. But what we started to see is as demand for commodities, particularly African commodities and oil and some of the minerals, started to decline. We started to see mines shut down in Africa. We started to see investments that were in the pipeline going into Africa, particularly in infrastructure, which you mentioned is absolutely a problem. We started to see some of those projects get put on the back burner. So we are going to see a growth impact in Africa. It's not super severe. But it will depend what happens in the coming months. If this becomes a prolonged global downturn, then Africa will continue to feel the effects. If there's a rebound in prices, I think Africa will see the bounce.
Bob Johnson, what about you? How have your ventures in Africa been affected by the downturn?
Yeah, Michelle, I think Todd's right. A lot of African nations depend on government focus to deal with some of their particular problems, particularly infrastructure, debt reduction, and the like. And when the large economies are focused on their own problems, Africa ultimately has to take a back seat to that. However, I will say this, and this is absolutely true. In any country where you see an opportunity for growth, the risk is great, but the reward is even greater. And if you invest early in a relationship with the government, where the government is committed to transparency, you can do very well. It's a long run. You don't go into Africa and expect to get your money out in the next week. You're in there for a long term, but that's the benefit of being there. You establish opportunities that can expand into other businesses throughout the country.
Yusuf, what are you seeing?
I really agree. There are a lot of challenges. In the economic recession, although it is not felt in a big way as it has been felt in the West, but Africa has been affected, especially by the export market. On the export side, the commodity price has gone down in the non-traditional, non-oil exporting. Africa has been hurt on that area. Another one that hurt Africa economy is Africans in the diaspora, who used to send quite a lot of money, close to $6 billion a year. That also has been reduced. Many African living in the United States have been hurt because of this real estate crisis or loss of employment. They are not able to send money as they used to.
Todd Moss, we're down to our last minute. I'm going to give you the final word and like to ask, what do you think is the most important thing that U.S. officials particularly can do to encourage more investment in Africa, if anything?
I think that the U.S. already has a lot of instruments for encouraging private investment. The Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which is not a very well-known agency, actually helped to catalyze the private equity fund that Bob Johnson mentioned in Liberia. They've got about 13 private equity funds to bring private money and public money together to really try to create new markets. There's tremendous opportunity to grow that. But I think Yusuf actually hit on a critical point, which is the circularity of skilled Africans globally can have a tremendous effect back in Africa. And so the more the U.S. can encourage skilled migration circularity, allow African professionals to come work in the U.S., the more we'll see them go back and start businesses in Africa and really start to see Africa integrate into the global economy.
Todd Moss is a senior fellow and director of the Emerging Africa Project at the D.C.-based Center for Global Development. He's a former deputy assistant secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the U.S. State Department. He joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Bob Johnson is the co-founder of Black Entertainment Television. Since then, he founded and now serves as chairman for RLJ Development, which recently built a beachfront resort and hotel complex in Liberia. He joined us by phone from Italy. And Yusuf Reja is the chief executive officer of Zebra Jobs. It's a web portal that brings together employers in Africa and job seekers from the diaspora worldwide. And he joined us on the phone as well. Gentlemen, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The Obama administration did some backpedaling on taxes this week. Just one day after top economic advisors suggested a tax hike might be possible, White House spokesman Robert Gibbs rejected that idea. But there are some signs that Americans are less concerned about taxes than they've been in decades. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner didn't exactly threaten to raise taxes on the middle class, but he didn't exactly rule it out either when pressed this week by ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
The president has said the taxes won't go up for any Americans earning under $250,000, but it doesn't appear he's going to be able to keep that promise if you're going to bring the deficits down.
George, again, we can't make these judgments yet about exactly what it's going to take and how we're going to get there. But we do not have a choice as a country. If we want an economy that's going to grow in the future, we have to bring those deficits down.
White House economic advisor Larry Summers was equally cautious, telling CBS, in effect, never say never. But no sooner had Geithner and Summers opened the door to a middle-class tax hike than White House spokesman Robert Gibbs stepped forward to slam it shut.
Reiterating the president's clear commitment in the clearest terms possible that he's not raising taxes on those who make less than $250,000 a year.
Gibbs was emphatic. He left no wiggle room. It was almost as if he'd said,
"Read my lips. No new taxes."
George Herbert Walker Bush was thrown out of office because he said he wouldn't raise taxes, and he did.
Conservative activist Grover Norquist has built a career out of getting politicians to swear a blood oath against higher taxes and trying to draw blood whenever they backslide. For Norquist, who heads a group called Americans for Tax Reform, there is no cause, not war, nor hurricane, nor yawning budget deficits, that could justify asking the American people to pay more.
No, there's not. Politicians have 101 reasons to raise taxes. If you want to spend more on X, you can spend less on Y. There's no shortage of cash.
For years, that opposition to higher taxes, at least on the middle class, has defined the playing field for American politicians. The Gallup organization has been asking people since the mid-1950s if they think their own taxes are too high, too low, or about right. Gallup's Frank Newport says almost no one ever volunteers that their taxes are too low.
I don't think anybody is desperate to pay more taxes except maybe a few very rich people. I guess Barack Obama always says, well, I make a lot of money and I'm willing to pay more taxes, so maybe he would be willing to do it, but most Americans aren't.
But Newport does note something unusual this year. Less than half the people surveyed, 46%, complained their taxes are too high. That's the smallest fraction since 1961. And for only the second time in decades, a slightly larger group of people actually thought their taxes were about right.
So Americans, relatively speaking, are more satisfied with the amount of taxes they pay than they have been at most other times in history. Some people might say now's the time to pounce.
But the Obama administration seems unwilling to test that. Bill Gale, who directs the Tax Policy Center at the Brookings Institution, calls that unfortunate. Sooner or later, he says, the government is going to have to raise taxes on the middle class to get its fiscal house in order. And he says politicians should be making that case, not ducking it.
Saying that you're never going to raise taxes on people with income below $250,000 is definitely leadership, but it's leadership in the wrong direction. It's telling people what they want to hear rather than what they need to hear.
Gale suspects people are more willing to pay taxes during periods when the government is seen as playing an important role. During World War II, tax rates for the wealthy soared as high as 94%. But poor and middle-class families also paid taxes at rates substantially higher than today's. Despite those high taxes, the vast majority of Americans surveyed by Gallup back then said the taxes they paid were fair. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
President Obama goes to Elkhart, Indiana today in his latest trip to a hard-hit manufacturing region to talk about reviving the economy. Just south of Elkhart is Kokomo, Indiana, where the unemployment rate is hovering around 20%. Indiana is a state that's unusually dependent on manufacturing, including auto manufacturing, and many longtime auto workers there are now choosing to get the education they passed up years ago. From member station WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, Ariana Prothero reports.
Jimmy. Andrew. Jason.
The roll call at Kokomo's Ivy Tech Community College branch is longer since the latest bout of economic troubles hit the U.S. auto industry. The school's ranks are swelling with laid-off factory workers, many who are attending college with the help of trade adjustment assistance. It's a federal program that pays for retraining of workers whose jobs have been hurt by foreign trade or competition. Kim Hatfield is one of those students. After working for Chrysler for 10 years, Hatfield was laid off in February of last year. 1 year to the day of losing her job, she suffered a massive heart attack that her doctors say was caused in part by the stress of unemployment. With the financial help offered through the TAA program, Hatfield decided it was time for a change.
My thing was, is like I thought about it previously, and at this point it was like, man, this is a great opportunity because it's paid for. I mean, our books are even paid for. So it was like you'd be a fool not to take it.
Looking for the kind of job security that has become elusive in the auto industry, Kim Hatfield enrolled in Ivy Tech's medical assistant program. She and many of her peers haven't set foot in a classroom since high school. For some, like Danny Spalding, that's a 30-year hiatus. Spalding is heading back to school because he's grown tired of the ups and downs of the auto industry.
I've known it's been a roller coaster ride in the auto industry for 20-some years. It just seems like right now we're on a straight down path.
Former auto workers like Hatfield and Spalding are exactly who Indiana unemployment officials want to see. Spokesman Mark Lauder says one of the chief challenges is combating the mindset that manufacturing jobs will always exist in places like Kokomo.
They believe my job will come back. It has many times before. Over the past many years, we need to start people thinking, maybe it's time for me to look to something different.
And Lauder says the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program is expanding to accommodate an increasing number of workers looking for a new career.
And in fact, the stimulus bill contained another expansion of TAA, which we're still working with the U.S. Department of Labor to get the rules and the guidelines for what all that entails.
Kim Hatfield and Danny Spalding say they're torn, though, between embracing a new path or going back someday to build Chryslers. Both opted not to take a buyout, which means there's a possibility they could be called back to work if orders pick up. But there's a catch. If they go back to work, they'll lose their TAA funding and won't be able to afford tuition. If they leave Chrysler, they give up their medical coverage. It's a dicey trade-off, and although Hatfield says she too wants a change from the roller coaster ride of the auto industry, the lure of Chrysler benefits remains strong.
It's just not knowing what's going to happen, and like your kids need insurance, and I don't know. A lot to worry about, so now you figure out that you got to let a lot of that go because there's just nothing you can do. But this is a step, you know, in a direction, well, maybe I can get out of that.
Kim Hatfield still regularly attends her union meetings for news on Chrysler, but until she hears differently, she'll stick to the books. For NPR News, I'm Ariana Prothero.
If paying taxes is painful for you, our next story may offer a bit of relief. There is new research on the intersection of money and pain. A scientifically conducted experiment shows that counting money, just counting currency, can make things hurt less. NPR's David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team has that story.
Like many psychological experiments, this one involved a lot of students and a certain amount of deception. Okay, let's call it lying. Students were brought into the lab and told they were there for a test not of pain and money, but finger dexterity.
Yeah, right, exactly.
This is one of the researchers, Kathleen Voss.
Associate professor of marketing at the Carlson School of Management, University of Minnesota.
The students were given real money and told to count it.
So these experiments were run in China. Those were 100 renminbi bills, the equivalent of a $14 bill.
This was just to kind of tickle the brain with the idea of money. Remind students that, hey, money exists. Now, the pain part. About 10 minutes later, after filling out some forms to kind of put the whole money thing in the past, some of the students were asked to place their fingers in a bowl of hot water, 122 degrees Fahrenheit. Not hot enough to do lasting damage, but I should point out it's hotter than the Consumer Product Safety Commission recommends for your hot water heater at home, though you can get there pretty quickly with the office microwave. I brought a bowl of water into the studio, and it happens to be right at 122 degrees right now.
Oh, good. What's it feel like?
Hang on a second. Ow. Yeah. Well, if you keep your fingers in there, it's pretty uncomfortable.
Okay, good. So it's like a hot tub that's a bit uncomfortable. You really have to settle into it. Is that right?
Yeah, that seems right. Yeah.
Good. Okay. Boy, I never did that. That's a fault on my part.
They asked the students to rate how uncomfortable the water felt. For comparison, the researchers repeated the experiment with a second group of students. Instead of counting money, those students counted blank paper.
Well, the subjects who had earlier been counting money and had their hands in the painfully hot water reported that the water didn't feel so hot to them relative to subjects who'd earlier counted slips of paper.
So you're telling me that if I had just counted a bunch of dollar bills for my wallet, this water would not hurt me so much?
Well, dollar bills, I mean, don't know if dollar bills would work, but certainly 20s should work in this case. Yeah, that's the idea.
That seems sort of surprising.
It is surprising. It surprises me still.
So why would this happen? That's harder to explain.
One thing we would ask our subjects is this whole litany of questions about how they feel. Do they feel happier or sadder? And the only item, and it's just a single item, but it pops out in every single time we asked it, is this item of strong. So when subjects had been reminded of money, 10 minutes later, they said inexplicably they just felt stronger.
So maybe being reminded of money makes you feel stronger, less vulnerable, which translates into feeling less pain.
It's a substantial finding. I mean, in many ways, has the potential to be something of a discovery, which we don't always have all that often in psychology.
Nicholas Epley is a professor of behavioral science in the University of Chicago's Business School. He says this appears to be an elaborate case of something called priming, where thinking about one thing can subconsciously trigger a related thing.
So think about old people. And lots of associations are likely to come to mind, like walking slowly, for instance. It turns out that if you make people think about old people, lo and behold, they then walk more slowly in an experiment.
That's true?
Yeah, that's true.
Wow.
Barge, Chen, and Burroughs, 1996, Journal of Personality and Social Psychology.
Weird.
Yeah, no, crazy finding.
The new research on pain and money was published in the journal Psychological Science. Economists have, of course, studied money for ages, how prices efficiently direct the flow of resources. But meanwhile, in our little heads, money appears to be acting a bit like aspirin. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
If the economy gives you a headache, find prescriptions on our Planet Money blog at thenewnpr.org.